I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:36 p.m. on Friday, February 20th, 2026. Present today are Representative Allard, Representative Bynum, Representative Hannon, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Jimmy, Co-Chair Foster, Co-Chair Shragi, and myself, Co-Chair Josephson. Also present today are House Finance Committee staff, Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Tallulah-Lestefka, Secretary Bree Wiley, and Secretary Leah Frazier. We also have our moderator, Emily Mesh, from the Legislative Information Office with us. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. In today's meeting, we will hear two presentations. The first will be an overview from the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Then we will hear the Department of Revenue present on its FY27 budget overview. With us today from the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation is Devin Mitchell, Chief Executive Officer and Executive Director, and Marcus Frampton, Chief Investment Officer. Gentlemen, if both of you will come forward and put yourselves in the record, you can begin your presentation.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Devin Mitchell. I'm the Executive Director and Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. I have Marcus Frampton with me today, our Chief Investment Officer, and we'll be going through the presentation. I'll start off. Marcus will cover the middle and then jump back to me. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk to the committee in these annual touches. It's Alaska's most important resource from a revenue generation perspective at this point, with 66% was the last number I heard of the state's unrestricted general fund revenue flowing from the permanent fund. And the fact that we have this resource is because the people that lived in Alaska in 1976 elected to save money for us rather than spending it on themselves. And this is the 50th year anniversary of that event and is something that's worth celebrating, and we appreciate the opportunity to discuss it every chance we get. 75,588 Alaskans voted for the constitutional amendment to create the permanent fund. That was 67% of the voting population at that time. So a landslide, if you will, and again, we're very appreciative of their vision to transform one-time resource revenue into what we have today, which is a renewable resource generating revenue from the world's economy. The original constitutional amendment did three relatively simple things. First, it said we're going to save money. At least 25% of certain revenue streams are going to be saved. Second, it said that we'll invest the money. And then third, it said that all of the money will be available to the general fund unless otherwise provided by law. And so those were the components of the constitutional amendment. And subsequently, there was a statutory framework wrapped around it that gives us some of the structure that we have today with the corporation and the other sideboards that we operate within. If you think about that concept of if all the money had been spent rather than the statutory framework created, that on the chart on the screen, the kind of brownish total royalty deposits line is how much money would be in the permanent fund right now. So around $20 billion would be in the permanent fund rather than the $86 billion that we had at the time of our last financial statements. You can see the breakdown of principal and the earnings reserve account. There's more complexity to it than's reflected in this particular slide, but this is the general concepts that most people are most aware of. Total return and realized return or statutory net income are the two things that we track. Money becomes available to spend under the realized return, which is statutory net income, but total return is how our funds invested. The lines that go across the chart, the light blue line is the statutory net income or realized return, and the gold is total return. You can see total return is more volatile, but on average it's higher. And so that's why at the current time we have around $17 billion of unrealized gains that have yet to be realized but are part of the total return that the funds provided historically. So at the corporation, you have a group of around 60 right now, highly dedicated Alaskans and investment professionals that are working to provide the best value for the state of Alaska and the other residents of the state. We are mission-driven and have high ideals for our conduct and the work we provide. We have a 6-member board of trustees that's appointed by the governor, 4 of them from the general public, 2 from the cabinet, 1 of which must be the commissioner of the Department of Revenue. And they oversee the asset allocation of the fund and hire and fire the executive director.
Yes, Representative Allard.
Thank you. And I just I want you to repeat it a little louder on record, that every single one of the board of trustees is appointed by the governor, and that it's not they're not by the legislature. I like it like this. I like that the governor has done this, so I just want, can you repeat that again? A little louder.
Yes, Mr. Mitchell.
Through the chair, Representative Allard. Yeah, sure, I can move the mic closer to my mouth. We have 6 trustees, 2 of which are members of the cabinet, and 4 of which are appointed by the governor on 4-year staggered terms. And so all of them, of course, the cabinet as well as the public members are appointed by the governor at this point.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. And since we stopped there, just out of curiosity, because you currently have a acting commissioner at Revenue, is Ms. Earle serving in that seat pending confirmation or,
Mr. Mitchell.
Nodding her head.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon. Yes, that's normal. I was the acting commissioner at one point of the Department of Revenue and attended a Permanent Fund Corporation Board meeting, and I'm well aware of other prior acting commissioners that have attended Permanent Fund Corporation Board meetings. And Janelle, yes, has been attending our meetings and participating in a positive fashion.
Okay. All right, please continue.
So as far as the framework, we do rely on the legislature for approval of our budget. And I think that having as many eyes looking at the corporation and the permanent fund as possible is always going to be for the betterment of our state and the operation of the fund. We obviously, like I said, are operating to a high standard, and if you don't think we are, you should let us know, and we'll explain how come we're conducting ourselves like we are, and we can all talk about whether or not there's other ways that we should accomplish our mission. The other money that we might manage, there's a sub-account of principal within the fund called the Amaretta Hess Settlement. We also manage the Mental Health Trust Fund and the Power Cost Equalization Program. And monies, and so those two mental health trust and PCE programs are around $2 billion that are added to our balance, and so we're around $91 billion that we're running today, which is more than our, if you did the math, more than what we say we have as a fund balance, but it's not, that's just assets without consideration of any liabilities.
Okay. Slide 6.
As far as the fund's investment, when you look back at 1976 in the state of Alaska, and I think it carries forward to today, unfortunately, that the state's economy is viewed as narrow and concentrated in resource development. And that was true in 1976. It's less true today, but it's still how the broader market views our state. And so having the ability to convert our primary revenue stream from our economy to the worldwide economy is one of the amazing successes of the Alaska Permanent Fund. The asset allocation, how the fund is invested, has changed over the years. So initially, it was very conservative, all fixed income. That was in part due to just the conservative nature of the day in combination with the fact that equities had underperformed in the decade of the 1970s. And so you'd come off a time frame where the risk of equities hadn't provided a return relative to fixed income, so it made a lot of sense. As we went through time, there were additional authorizations, flexibility provided by the legislature to allow us to invest in other asset classes. where real estate and public equity was added, and then in 2006, a more broad authorization where we have the Board of Trustees has fairly broad discretion in determining how the fund is invested. We added absolute return and private equity in 06, and then subsequently have the portfolio composition that's shown in the pie chart with the addition of some other private income, and then just a notion of the cash that's held within the portfolio. And this combination of asset allocation is designed to hit a risk target equivalent to 80% equities, 20% fixed income. And so it's intended to be an at-risk portfolio. If you consider these asset classes and how they compile, which CIO Frampton will describe in a few moments, that equates to similar risk. It's just in a more diversified fashion where you'll have different cash flows at different periods of time. So on a short-term basis, you might have underperformance or outperformance relative to any one of these particular asset classes, but over the long term, we expect outperformance.
Director Mitchell, question from Co-Chair Shragi for you.
Yeah, thank you, Director Mitchell. Appreciate you being here. One of the questions that we get frequently that I've heard opined on the floor and on the radio is, why aren't you guys just investing in an index fund? The returns are good there, low management cost. It's really easily understood by a lot of the public why the benefits of the index funds, but can you just put in simple terms why you don't take that simple approach and just invest in your classic index fund?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shragi, I'd actually like to give CIO Frampton the opportunity. I could answer that question, but I think that I would be saying the things that I would have heard from his mouth.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Shragi, I think it's a really good question because I think index and passive investing is a very sound investment approach. I think the most vocal argument around passive investing has been around the S&P 500, which has been the last 15 years have been like a uniquely strong period for the S&P 500. And if you look at prior decades, there are periods where if you did a back test with a 5% POMV, it would be fairly devastating to be only S&P 500. So I think that argument is pretty easily countered, but you can invest in a diversified fashion with passive and index philosophy, and that is more sound. Among the U.S. state funds, the state of Nevada has embraced index investing more than anyone. They still have – I've heard people mischaracterize what Nevada does. They have a global stock portfolio that's indexed, so not S&P. So their stock portfolio has underperformed the S&P 500 because without the benefit of hindsight, you wouldn't have known 15 years ago. But they have indexed, and they have a global stock portfolio, and they have a bond portfolio that's indexed. They invest in private equity, but they outsource the implementation, and the same with real estate. So they've got a diversified portfolio just like we do, and they have one employee on the investment staff. And that's a good model, I think. I think that it's worked well for them and is valid. I think, so in the next section, I'm going to go through our investment performance and talk about how I would suggest stakeholders look at how we've done. But I think stakeholders should be aware that there is an index approach that is valid. You're going to see that we've, against the performance benchmark that I suggest we look against and which has been consistent in the 13 years I've been at the fund, we've beaten it over the 10-year and over the 5-year, and we've had softer performance over the 3-year, the more recent period. And I'll go through why that is, but you asked why not just do that, and I think that institutions, particularly institutions that have limited resources or who don't want to put the cost and effort into one of the most difficult games in the world, beating an index, totally valid approach. I think we've distinguished ourselves with our performance, and I think we've got strong arguments why our active approach makes sense and that we've delivered on it over 5-10 years. But over time, I mean, everyone should be aware that there's the Nevada model is a valid approach.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bynum for either Mr. Frampton, who just spoke, or the director.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice and Mr. Frampton. So when you talk a little bit here in a moment about performance and we're talking about how well we're doing in the different models that are available to us, one of the things I'd hope that you'd be able to address is the discussion of fees and the cost of actually doing that work. So, you know, I hear from the public quite a bit, and you guys probably see the chatter out there in the interwebs talking a little bit about the cost of actually trying to get performance and, you know, why don't we do this or do that. And so I'd really hope that we could kind of cover that because, you know, you could say I'm earning 8% and this managed fund is only earning 7.5% until this is better, but if I'm charging three times the cost to get that performance and there's not a net gain, that's the kind of thing that I think that we really need to understand. Thank you.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Bynum, I'll comment on that now and then I'll cover it as I go through. I mean, the first principle is that if you have fees, you should report your returns net of fees, and we do that. I've seen, and I mean, there's a lot of op-eds, talk, different. I've seen instances where our fund performance has been discussed and then a deduction is made for a net of fee return, and that's not accurate. Our returns are reported net of fee. One of the unfortunate things in the investment industry is that the industry is good at hiding fees and netting them out of the investment and showing them different ways. And when you look at our peers, the vast majority of state funds don't honestly report their fees. And the biggest category is private equity carried interest. And that can be looked at as a profit share. You know, so 17% of our portfolio is private equity. When our private equity managers achieve at least an 8% return, after that amount, the incentive kicks in 20% to the firm, 80% to the client. Most state funds do not report that number. In fact, in the United States, there's probably 8 or 9 that disclose a fee report with that. We're in that category. And so when you add up all the fees and show how we report it against how state of Washington reports it or one of the California plans, their board asked for that number and the staff doesn't even track it. You know, so everyone doesn't even track it because it's like a profit share. And so when you look at funds with our asset allocation and you do fee benchmarking, we're on the extreme efficient side. Like, we're the most efficient, and I can share those numbers. But when you show funds with our asset allocation as reported, we look expensive because we include all the fees, and almost everyone doesn't include all the fees. With that said, our model is more expensive than the Nevada model. But when you look at our model, we operate very efficiently.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. And I think my question is actually for the Department of Revenue, although the PERM Fund may know, and it's continuing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the same thread, do our other investment fees, investments that the Department of Revenue manages report net of fees also so that we are looking at apples to apples within our own investment wings?
Director. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, they do report net of fee performance. I'm not certain if they tease out profit share on their private market investments or not. I would defer. But certainly the information that they provide is going to be net of fee because that's the standard.
Okay. All right. We're on slide 6. Is it? You want to move on or you, okay? Slide 7.
Slide 7 is designed to show the difficulty or the variance in hitting a 5% draw rate expectation. So the chart shows a gold dot going across, and that is a target rate of 5% plus inflation. So a 5% draw plus you're able to maintain the purchasing power of your fund. And then the bars are 10-year look back, so 10-year averages of return and inflation. So inflation is also return, but it's deducted from return for purposes of calculating real return. So you can see that for around the first six of these bars, the performance exceeds the target gold dot. And then for a period of around 10 years, it doesn't hit the target. And then again, it starts hitting the target. And so it's a probabilistic analysis when you start saying what's the likelihood that we're going to be able to provide CPI plus 5 with a portfolio with a risk tolerance of 80% equities, 20% fixed income, and it's about half the time. And so it's just a chart designed to show that 5% is a relatively high target draw rate, but is achievable if you adhere to fiscal discipline over the long term. And Marcus, did you have some comments?
Mr. Frampton.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. Well, at this point, the following slides I'm going to cover, starting with how to think about the performance of the fund. But just starting on this slide, like I said, I started around 13 years ago in 2012 at the fund, and we hadn't achieved a CPI plus 5 over a trailing 10-year basis for several years at that point, coming out of the financial crisis. And then by the time we got to 2019, we were back around CPI plus 5 and then higher on a 10-year basis. And it mostly has to do with how the markets are doing. So in the decade of the 2000s, it was a very difficult equity market. We had the dot-com bust and then the global financial crisis. So almost no portfolios hit CPI plus 5 at that point. And going forward, like Devin said, we think there's about a 50% chance that we'll achieve CPI plus 5, and that's the same as the history here on this page. And there are three yardsticks that, at a high level, we can look at on performance. I'll start at the bottom of this page and go up. And just to note the time periods here, the fund's been around 50 years, but we've worked with Cowen Associates as our consultant for 42 years, and we have good performance data for the last 42 years, so that's why that's the longest time period. Later, I'm going to get to how staff and the board works through asset allocation, but suffice it to say, that's the first cut at trying to achieve a portfolio that achieve CPI plus 5. If there was an investment security that yielded CPI plus 5, we would just invest in that security. But inflation-protected bonds issued by the U.S. government give you about a 2% real return today. So to get to a portfolio of inflation plus 5, by definition, you have to take investment risk. And we build a diversified portfolio that is targeting with about a 50% probability CPI plus 5, and we mitigate the risk inherent in that through diversification. And you'll see over the 42 years, we've achieved better than CPI plus 5 by close to 1%. The five-year period is the toughest look on inflation plus 5, and that is because inflation's been so high. Like over the last 5 years, inflation's been almost 5%, so you had to do 9.5% to hit that, and the fund did 7.9%. Over that time period, I think the average risk-free interest rate is probably 2%. So that 7.9 is vastly more than you would have gotten like in a bank account or something like that, but did not achieve the inflation plus 5. And then more recently, as inflation's come under control, the performance of the fund has greatly exceeded the CPI plus 5. I think at the end of the day, that measure, CPI plus 5, mostly should be looked at on a 10-year basis like we did on the previous page, and it's a yardstick of do we have the right asset allocation to achieve this type of return. It's less to do with, you know, are we picking the right managers, or are we investing in the right real estate, things like that. It's mostly an asset allocation assessment. Once we arrive at an asset allocation, I'm going to get to how we do it in a minute, the performance benchmark is created. And on the previous slide with the pie chart on the assets, wherein Devin had a page that shows we're 32% global stocks. So our performance benchmark is 32% what did global stocks do. We're 20% fixed income. The performance benchmark has 20% institutional fixed income on average, how it's doing. And so every asset class in its proportion, how it did on average versus how we did. And so I think that benchmark is the measure of, is our active management versus like a Nevada model adding value. And so interestingly, like if you look at the 42-year period, we have underperformed on that measure, the far right column. You could debate how good or bad that is. The benchmarks don't deduct fees. Even if you're indexed, you're going to be charged some fees. But over 42 years, the fund has underperformed its performance benchmark by 0.09%. When you get more recent, over the last 10 years, we've beaten by 30 basis points, 0.33%. And since I've been at the fund over that period, an observation I have is that 13 years ago, we had a very conservative orientation. And I think everyone at the fund then and now has always worked very hard to do their best for our stakeholders. But there are investment institutions that take a little bit more risk, and there are ones that want to hold a little extra cash and take a little less risk and be more conservative. And the ethos 13 years ago was definitely conservative. And I think we're balancing in the last decade performance and risk aversion a little bit better, and that's showing up in the 10-year number where it's beating. And over 5 years, we're also beating by 16 basis points. Probably the single biggest driver of why on the 3-year number we're underperforming is a decision we made in our largest asset class, public equities, to underweight very large, very expensive tech stocks. And that's hurt us. We've looked at that trade over, or that investment decision over, called a 5-year time frame, and it feels to me like it's really playing in our direction now coming into this calendar year. It's not the type of thing that's on the front page of the paper, but it's on page 4 of the paper. If you read the business section, is the Mag 7, the software companies, are really underperforming coming into 2026. They were viewed as AI beneficiaries, and the market's starting to consider them at risk to AI, and they're at very high prices, so they're coming under pressure. So on the performance benchmark, I think a good result on 5 and 10, and I feel like the setup's good where we'll be good on 1 year and 3 year as this cycle plays out this year. The last measure I'll go through is the passive benchmark. That's another way to think about like an indexed approach. I'm not aware of any state pension funds or big investment funds that invest purely passive. I noted Nevada was the closest, but they're still in private markets. We did the passive benchmark as a measure of something you could invest in with like a click of a mouse, which is one step more indexed than even like a Nevada. And that measure is 60% global equities, 20% fixed income, 10% REITs, real estate securities, and 10% TIPS. It's meant to be a diversified portfolio that can be indexed with a click of a mouse. And the phenomenon I'm about to describe is not recent. It's been the case the entire time I've been at the fund of, in short periods of time, anytime the stock market does very well like it has the last few years, because the passive index is 60% stocks and we have half that stock mix in our portfolio, we'll underperform the passive if stocks are doing well on the short term. And in the converse, like in 2022, I think we beat the passive benchmark by 10% or something. It's because the stock market corrected and we've got private assets that don't move with the stock market. The thing that's been consistent is when you look at like 5-year, 10-year, the time I've been at the fund, we've generally been beating the passive benchmark, where the vagaries of the stock market year to year kind of even out into the 5 and 10 years. So I threw a lot at you, and I know there's a lot of talk about our performance, but that's how I would look at it.
Mr. Frampton, we have questions from Co-Chair Shragi and then Rep. Hannon.
No, I don't think so right now.
All right. Representative Hannon, then Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Chair Josephson, and I apologize because I can't remember exactly what we called it, but the private equity Alaska focus, Alaska equity investment. And help remind me when we started that, and I believe it was last year that we had a slide on it and discussed that we've pretty much exited those, and I'm looking to see whether they're showing in our 10-year or our 5-year benchmarks. And it wasn't a huge percent, but tell me how that impacted our performance benchmarks.
Mr. Frampton?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, so the decision the board made was to formally like discontinue the investments. So we committed $200 million in 2018 to two firms. They invested in private companies with some nexus to the state of Alaska. Because it's illiquid, we still have that exposure, with the exception of a couple of companies that have done so poorly that we don't have the exposure anymore, unfortunately. So we still have over $100 million with it, and our private equity portfolio is $15 billion, of which this is $200 million. That program's performed quite poorly, but it's a bit of a rounding error on the overall results.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Joseph, and through the chair. So I'm looking at this top box on the right, your 8.8%. Does that include, are the management fees taken before we see this number?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
Are we going to, do you guys have a graph, maybe you have it in, up here, on what the management fees are for each year, your total cost of your management of the fund?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, we'll follow up with that, but just to give you a rough number, the number is over $900 million for the last 12 months, measured as we measure it. If you measure it the way State of Washington or CalPERS measures it, it's probably a third of that.
Okay, and follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
I get questions like I'm kind of, like Representative Bynum spoke about, I get questions about the fund and the fund performance, and if you look at just simple, like you're talking about an index fund, the S&P 500, over that last 42-year duration produced an average of 11.69% in those 42 years. So kind of walk me through, how do we justify doing this active management portfolio distribution when we could be getting, well, in this case, almost 3% yearly average return, above what we're getting.
Mr. Frampton.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, there's two concepts in there. One is how well the S&P 500 did. I think that's a really bad argument that gets made when people say the S&P 500, because if you look at three out of the last 10 decades, if you look at the 1930s, which was the Great Depression, you look at the 1970s, or you look at the decade of the 2000s, those are 10-year periods, and three out of the last 10, so these are not like isolated events. The S&P 500 had like basically a zero return in like those periods, And if you had a 5% POMV, half the fund would be eroded before you talk about inflation. And then when you add inflation in, it would get eroded further down to probably like a third of the starting value in the decade. And so like when people look at back tests and they end it with a 15-year period that's like the you couldn't pick a 15-year period where the S&P 500 shone brighter. With hindsight, yes, I wish the whole fund was in the S&P 500, but no one knew that 15 years ago. You can't find us, or I would challenge anyone to find an institutional fund, a state government fund, or a university endowment that went S&P 500 15 years ago. 100% of them wish they did with hindsight. I would challenge anyone to find a fund of that category whose equity portfolio is all S&P 500. Generally speaking, our industry has accepted the argument that there's a benefit to diversification. In any time period, if you look back and look at the thing that did the best, you wish you weren't diversified, you wish you were just in that thing, but we don't have the luxury of doing that. So, like, I think that the S&P 500, like, we could run the fund against a benchmark of the S&P 500, and we could do it passive or we could do it active, as people desired. I would argue against it because I think if you look at difficult market environments like the three I cited and couple it with a POMV, I think it would be a devastatingly bad decision. So that's the first part, is the S&P 500. But the second part is, how do we justify active versus passive? Because you could have an S&P 500 benchmark for the fund and you could do it passively or actively. The active versus passive, I justify because in the last 5 and 10 years, when you look at what our mandate actually was, the mix of assets we actually were running money against, we outperformed it. I noted to Representative Shragi that the Nevada model is a good model. And if we are not beating it, if it was not the case that we beat it over 5 and 10 years, that model should be considered. And I mean, if there was an argument to invest in the S&P 500, I would argue so strenuously against it for the reason I said. The Nevada model is harder to argue against, but I think because we've achieved outperformance over reasonable investment horizons, it validates our active approach.
Yeah, follow up.
Follow up, and then we're going to have to
kickstart for that. So I can't remember which one of you mentioned before that once you reach 8%, then the managers get 20% of any increase, and the fund gets 80%. Is that a correct statement, or did I?
Through the chair, Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, that is how fees work in the private equity industry. So our fund is 18% private equity, and that is the incentive fee model that prevails in private equity.
Okay, and follow-up.
Yes, follow-up.
And so just for clarification, the $900 million in management fees that it costs, I mean, we're looking at about 1% of the fund. Is that kind of – well, that if we were going to do an average and kind of figure out what it's going to cost, it would probably be about the 1% mark?
That's – Mr. Chair, this is Devin Mitchell again. I think that when you look at our fees that we report, you have to. Those are primarily concentrated in the private markets rather than our public market space. And we have a fee report that we put in each one of our quarterly board decks that describes all of the fees that are paid by the corporation. So if they're, I mean, it's when you talk to other fund managers, they're envious of our asset allocation, which does include private market exposure because of the diversification value that's perceived. And when you look at private equity in isolation, in 2021, for example, the S&P 500 was something like a 30% return, pretty good. what was our private equity performance, it was 60%. So it was double in that particular year. And when you look at longer periods of time in recent decades, it has outperformed the S&P 500 as well. In the last couple of years, that has reversed itself. Private equity has lagged and the public markets have excelled. But in aggregate, still, there's an expectation of outperformance in that particular asset class, and it comes at different times. And so it provides a diversifying value that Marcus was referring to when you have a draw in your fund and an exposure and overexposure to a particular asset class. But if there's a concern about fee structure, I think it's primarily focused on private markets.
And just one real quick.
Real quick.
I would really like to see that. You probably put it in your newsletter or whatever. I would love to see that kind of broken down and on the fees. Thank you.
Okay, let's turn to slide 9, and then Representative Bynum has a question.
Okay, I covered everything on this page.
Okay.
And actually probably this page.
All right, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. Really quick, I think Representative Tomaszewski brought up a good point. When you know, it's a lot of one of the things we hear a lot about is about fees. What does it cost us to actually manage our fund? And you're obviously tasked with that. And so one of the things we hear a lot of criticism about the cost, but one of the things I don't hear people really asking is what is it that you can do that can be more competitive and or lower fees or get us a better return without the higher cost? What is it that you would need from policymakers to make that happen, if at all? Maybe you are performing the best possible. The fees are as low as they ever could be, but maybe that's not the case. And if it's not the case, that's the question I would have. What is it that we can actually do to do that? And if it's a policy decision that we need to make to help you with that, we would like to know that.
Either gentleman?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Bynum, if you look at every industry's got benchmarking data, and there's a lot in institutional investing. And when I look at the data, we're like far on the extreme efficient. And the reason for our asset allocation, to be clear, I think the reason is that we've, like in the very high fee areas like private equity, we've been very aggressive about co-investing with the managers, so we don't pay fees when one of our private equity managers does a deal and we go into the deal with them, and that averages down the fees. And you know, in the time I've been CIO, the investment department's grown from probably 14, 15 to 27, 28 people, and so we've had a period of growth in headcount the last 5 or 6 years, and I sort of feel like we're at the point where we're operating quite efficiently with our asset allocation. If there was a plan to reduce fees, it would be a reduction in the high fee alternative areas as a part of the asset allocation and more indexing in equities. It wouldn't be a resource thing that we need, in my opinion.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's look at slide 11.
Sure.
And the last comment was from a CIO, Frampton CIO. Please continue.
Yes. I think we've covered most of this, but I'll just hit a few points. I said this earlier, but I'm not aware of any peers of ours that invest in the S&P 500 other than as a portion of their stock portfolio. A move to that would be a real departure from what we see in the industry. We feel like the S&P 500 today is very concentrated in the technology sector, and we feel like that concentration increases the risk. And history, as I noted, shows periods of underperformance. And then just lastly, like the enabling statute or the statutes that create and direct us on how to invest the fund do require diversification, and we feel like from a legal perspective, we would be at risk of violating that statute that mandates us to invest with prudent diversification, and we've listed what that statute is there.
Okay. Slide 12.
So this is the asset allocation of the fund, and we arrive at this, like I said earlier, to build a portfolio that can be expected to achieve an inflation plus 5% return. On the right there, those are the capital market forecasts of our consultant Callan Associates. And so you can see on the right there that they believe, and those are net of fee numbers, they believe that private equity will return the highest at 8.5%. And that's really why you see institutional investors signing up to what is very high fee arrangements. Is the consensus is that that's the highest performing asset class. The second highest is global equities at 7.5, and on down the sheet to cash and fixed income at a return that would fall far short of what the fund needs to return. So when you add up our current asset allocation that's on the left there with those forecasts, Callan Associates projects a 7.3 nominal return over the next 10 years, and netting out inflation a 4.8. So we are targeting 5, and the gap between 4.8 and 5 is the level of outperformance that we'd be attempting to achieve. So over the last 10 years, we beat our benchmarks net of fees by 30 basis points. That would get us there. But it's important just to note that that's just a point estimate. Like, it's almost certain that the return over the next 10 years will not be 4.8 or 5. It's with about a 50% probability it'll be at least 5 is the way I would frame it.
Okay. Slide 13.
So I have a few slides now on how we make.
Apologies. Representative Jimmy has a question for either gentleman.
Yes, Jimmy. Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. And before we continue with the investment committee, I had a quick question. Have you ever performed a proxy voting audit on the APFD assets managers? And if yes, have any of the asset managers been voting in a way that would go against Alaskan resources development?
Director?
Through
Director
the
Mitchell.
Chair, Representative Jimmy. Yeah, we are aware of the concern about the impacts of proxy voting and the decision-making that's happened at times based on the undue influence of certain movements by getting into the boardroom through the ability to vote proxy shares. So we have... We use a service for the majority of our public equity asset class as far as how our shares are voted. We instruct them to have an approach that's designed to provide the maximum value in any decision that's being made rather than a decision process that would be based on some other metric, whether it was an environmental concern or a social concern or a governance concern. Those could be important to why some board consideration comes up, but it should be the economics that are considered, and so it's called board aligned. And we have had a review and a third party come in and look at a limited number of particularly flagrant proposals that have been made at various companies' boardrooms and how our proxies were voted. And that report reflected that in their opinion, we were generally voting our shares in a way that did align with that standard of what makes economic sense rather than what might be a more of a feel-good or other reason for a non-economic reason for pursuing a change. There were a couple of abnormalities that we addressed. We gave additional guidance to our staff and our managers to ensure that they were compliant with our goals of maximizing risk-adjusted return for the state of Alaska.
All right, slide 13.
Okay. So I have a few slides on how we make investment decisions, and then my final slides are just a couple slides about how statutory net income works. So we have an investment committee, and that's the body that makes discrete investment decisions, primarily around private market transactions. If we're buying a building, if we're committing to a private equity fund, et cetera, that runs through this committee. This committee also creates guidelines and risk parameters for areas like stocks and bonds where we've delegated the PM's authority to buy individual securities. And we run this committee internally at the Permanent Fund fairly transparently, so all the investment staff, interns up to asset class heads, are invited and attend. We've got the chief risk officer who reports to Devin. I also report to Devin, attends to monitor and ensure that we're following risk and compliance guidelines. And the committee has three voting members. It's myself, and then we have a deputy CIO private markets, and his name's Alan Waldrop, and a deputy CIO public markets, Jim Parise. So the three of us vote, and so, for example, like if I'm very excited about something and Alan and Jim aren't, it won't pass. After this, we've got a more robust due diligence process that I've just summarized here. Like when we commit to, like for example, a private equity fund, it's a 3 to 12 month process that starts with initial review, where our staff is looking at like all the available options, all the funds in the market, looking at their track record and their portfolio fit. So they'll take an initial meeting with almost any fund out there raising money. And then a portion of those will go to due diligence, where it's still APFC internal staff doing work, site visits, reviews with the manager if it's a fund. And along the way, the investment committee's kept up to date. So by the time it goes to that third stage, extensive due diligence, where we're like paying money for third-party consultants and third-party legal review and things like that, it's been fairly well vetted. I just wanted to highlight, I mean, I've got all the steps on this page. I won't read them all. But there is a detailed process with some rigor to it that we apply every investment to. And then once the investment committee's approved it, then it would go to the executive director to review. I just wanted to leave everyone with an understanding of how we make decisions around private opportunities and some confidence that, particularly given the amount of our portfolio in privates and the amount of fees we're paying there, that there's a process with rigor.
Okay.
Okay, my last few slides are about statutory net income. It's an important topic because this is the income that fills up the ERA, so obviously it's important in terms of having available funds for the POMV. This is the history of statutory net income going back to the mid-80s, and it does, with forecast 2026 forward, it does strike me just how variable it is historically and how steady it is going forward, which is often the nature of forecasts. I'm going to get into what drives statutory net income, but a big part is realizing gains on investments that have gone up in value. And those big years of 2018 and 2021 were big years for exiting appreciated investments. In 2018, we had two individual private market investments with billion-dollar gains that just the way it worked out, we exited those years, and you had that big spike. And then in 2021, it was a very strong stock market, and we continuously rebalanced back to our target, which was the biggest driver of that big number there. But the forecast is for numbers that have only historically been achieved in terms of statutory net income on a few occasions. And also just to highlight, in 2009, we had negative statutory net income because when the stock market goes down, we go from a gain position to a loss position in equities. And as we turn the portfolio over, we're spitting out losses, not gains. So it is possible to have negative a negative, or at least in 2009, we had a negative number.
All right.
The driver of statutory net income is twofold. The most reliable is what I'm calling baseline statutory net income. So that's interest payments, dividends, and rental income on property we own. You'll see that last year we achieved $2 billion of those, which is, you know, on the forecast, it's $5 to $6 billion of statutory net income. So to get to the levels needed to refill the ERA, you need substantial gain, realization of unrealized gains. And as we sit at the end of December, we had $17 billion of unrealized gains in the portfolio. The biggest category was public equities at 6.7 and on down the list, private equity 4.6. That's that middle column on the right. When we analyze this and model it out, historically, we've I don't know if churn is the right word, but we've turned the portfolio over at a level that's realized about 25% of the unrealized gain balance. There's a wide variability in it, but that's the average. And so that's how you kind of get to a $6 billion number, which is the forecast, is the about $2 billion of baseline statutory net income and about $4 billion through portfolio movements applied to our gain balance today. It strikes me that the gain number is a bit hard to predict and subject to downside scenarios, which you see in the history with the variability of statutory net income. So if the stock market went down 25%, which happens with some regularity, that's about half of how much the stock market went down in 2008, it would take our public equity unrealized gains to a slightly negative number. And make it much harder for any stakeholder to, with reliability, believe that we would hit the $6 billion of statutory net income. And so I just highlight that there is variability to that number, and it's hard to forecast how gains flow through to statutory net income.
Okay.
And that's all I had.
All right, Director, back to you.
Mr. Chair, I might ask, how much time do you want to spend on these remaining slides so I can tailor my comments?
Thank you for asking. I would say 10 minutes.
Okay.
Question from Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. I just wanted to ask a really quick question before we move forward. And specifically, we looked a little bit a few minutes ago. We had slide 13. And it specifically was talking about, you know, the investment committee and kind of this process where we look at investments. And I was just, on a high level, curious on what role AI is playing in helping you guys do your job with investments. I'm not suggesting that it's going to take over, although we keep seeing jokes about Skynet. But, you know, we know that is a technology that is rapidly developing and advancing. It works 24 hours a day. So I was just curious on how that is playing a role in what you guys are doing on a day-to-day.
Mr. Frampton.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Bynum, we're working on making sure that we're availing ourselves of that benefit. So we're doing an implementation right now with Microsoft Copilot, is what it's called. We also have staff using the LLMs to do more easier functions like first cuts at memos and things like that. And I would say it's not a major part of our investment process, but we're trying to find efficiencies where we can. We have, like, in our hedge fund portfolio, managers that are, like, deep into machine learning for trading decisions, and we're not at the point today where we would do something like that. We're using it more for, like, general office and research efficiency.
Quick follow-up?
Mm-hmm. Follow-up. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice. And so, and specifically on management strategy, that's not something you're doing internally, but there are partners or firms that you're doing work with that potentially are heavily involved in that space. Is that accurate?
Mr. Frampton.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum. Yes. So, for example, like one of our biggest hedge fund managers is a firm called Bridgewater, and they've been a systematic trader of commodities, currencies, global markets for years. So for years, Bridgewater was a place where the team did research and then created trading rules for a machine to implement. And like that firm, for example, was an early investor at a firm level in OpenAI and some of the others, and they've like really embraced it. So that would probably be the biggest example. They're our largest hedge fund manager. There are some good podcasts with their founder on how they use AI. We're not close to that in terms of what we're comfortable doing, but we definitely have managers that are really making use of it.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's go to slide 18. Director?
Chair Josephson, I was surprised that Marcus didn't ask AI how to answer that question because, I mean, it's permeating every workplace, and it's not just the investment staff. Our technology staff, we just adopted a new firewall that integrates AI technologies to ensure that the corporation is protected from the AI bots that are trying to infiltrate the corporation's firewall. And so it is. It's everywhere you look, and we are focused on getting Copilot onto our desktops. But like Marcus said, there's already other pockets of use within the analytical teams, and we expect that just to grow as we go through time. We want to be very thoughtful about how we do that because there's risks associated with technology adoptions of that magnitude. We just wanted to celebrate that the fund has generated $114 billion in total earnings. $17 billion of that is unrealized. So $97 billion has been realized, and that money has been used for permanent fund dividends as well as providing services for the state of Alaska. The historical revenue stream of the state of Alaska was extraordinarily volatile. You've seen a stabilization of that through the use of the permanent fund starting in 2019 with the percent of market value transfers. And that stability has been incredibly beneficial and is now relied upon very heavily by the state of Alaska for everything that the state provides for our residents, including a permanent fund dividend.
Slide 21.
20 or 21? You want to skip 20?
Sorry, 20.
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is just showing that we have a historical draw. Our draw is calculated in the left. So you can see the last five completed fiscal years, average balance, 5% of that. That creates a number that 5% of that is $4 billion for the 27 draw that you guys are appropriating right now this legislative session. The chart on the right just shows ending fund balance in the gold bars and then the real rate of return on a historical and projected basis and then an effective POMV draws. You have an ascending balance and that historical average balance, you wind up with a draw rate that's actually less than 5%. And so it's been as low as 3.79, as high as 4.52 since inception. On page 21, we have some of that complexity I referred to earlier with the unrealized gains and how they fit into the earnings reserve and the principal. The balance of the unrealized gains sloshes back and forth between the two as the underlying balances go up or down. And so protected by the Constitution principle of the permanent fund right now is $59.1 billion. That's what cannot be spent. The other $27 billion is either in the earnings reserve or in unrealized earnings, but it's not protected by the Constitution. As far as the balance of the earnings reserve, we have the $4 billion segregated, committed for FY27, and then we have the unrealized gains appreciation that's held in the ERA as a placeholder, and then we have $6.6 billion of actual spendable earnings. So relatively healthy balance, which what I would note is in part because the legislature chose to forego inflation proofing in FY25 and the current FY26 because of concerns about sufficiency in the earnings reserve account. So the cost of maintaining sufficiency is foregoing inflation proofing, and that's just part of how the construct works at this point.
Director, the 13.4 figure, is that net of all the draws we're asking for FY26?
Yes.
Okay. So theoretically, setting aside realized or unrealized income that'll be coming in, if we draw four, we're at nine for at the end of FY27. Is that how that works? If we draw four for FY27, the ERA becomes $9 billion, setting aside the issue of course, all the income coming in.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
And that number strikes me as higher than it was a couple of years ago. Wasn't it down to like six at one point?
Yes. So there has been stress on the earnings reserve account. If you looked back at the beginning of last year, there wasn't quite enough money to set aside the draw for 26 to commit the draw on July 1. So you're a year in advance. You have earnings that are hopefully going to come in. You're not going to hopefully have a negative year. But there was a weakness there in liquidity of available balance, not liquidity in the sense that we don't have money. We have plenty of money. It's an accounting issue, a fund structure issue. And so that has been resolved in part by foregoing inflation proofing in 25 and 26, and then having a very strong statutory net income year. And so we've had very strong realization of earnings, and that in combination with foregoing inflation proofing has resulted in what's a relatively healthy balance. And it's $6.6 billion that I focus on, because the $4 billion, you know you're going to spend that in the coming year. The $6.6, that's for the future. The $2.8 billion of unrealized, that's this, it's kind of there, but it's not really there, because if you spend the other $10.6, the $2.8 would go back to principal. Does that mean, because it's just pro rata allocated and it sloshes around. So until and if it gets realized, that money is in this gray area, I'll call it.
This page suggests to me as you've said, it's praiseworthy, arguably, to not have inflation proofed. But should we now be looking at inflation proofing, given that we're more comfortable? Our position is more comfortable.
Mr. Chair,
is that advice that you offer the legislature, or are you unsure about offering that sort of advice?
Mr. Chair, our board has been very consistent about following a rules-based inflation proofing model. And so I would advocate that inflation proofing be appropriated in accordance with that. I respect the legislature's need to balance that future generation's inflation proofing with the needs of the current generation, meaning that we need to ensure that we can have a transfer this year for a reasonable draw. The percent of market value draw seems reasonable based on all of the literature and what my board supports. And so that it's as there are excesses of balances in the earnings reserve as we move through time, it requires the legislature to show discipline on the other side and potentially consider making appropriations into principal to make up for those foregone years. At this point, there is inflation proofing in the governor's budget, and we're supportive of that inflation proofing remaining in place.
Okay. And arguments that previous large deposits that were made reflect sort of the equivalent of inflation proofing. I'm told that those arguments are now, we've used those arguments and mathematically they're not repeatable.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. So there was a $4 billion transfer that was categorized on our books as a special transfer. So there's been special transfers from the general fund, from the earnings reserve account over the years, and we don't count those in our world as inflation proofing. And so one of the $4 billion transfers of recent times was in that category. The legislature determined that that transfer should actually be categorized as inflation proofing. My board disagreed with that. And so I'm kind of in the middle on that. So we're either $500 million behind on inflation proofing if you include the $4 billion as inflation proofing, or the $4.5 billion behind if you did not. So that's really how I would think about it in your chair, is that we're we're still a little behind either way, but maybe not as far off as, and as long as the money's in the principal, there's a value to that. I think you can take comfort in just money being protected by the Constitution.
Okay, Rep. Bynum for Director Mitchell.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the chair, is it possible we could get a report on specifically inflation proofing on where we're currently at, where we recommend that we should have been? Kind of be help us inform us if that's just something that we could get after the fact. And then I have a couple follow-up questions.
Director.
Yes, sir, we can get that for you.
Okay. Follow-up questions, Rep. Bynum.
Thank you. Specifically, I wanted to look at the 74.2 billion principal. Of that is 15.1 of unrealized. And when you were talking about that a moment ago, I missed the part. You were talking about being protected. Is the full 74.2 protected, or is it only the 59.1 and the unrealized portion is potentially not?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum. So constitutionally, the 59.1 billion is protected. The 15.1 billion that's unrealized, to the extent that is ever realized, it will flow over to the ERA and be spent. It will leave principal. So it's allocated there as a, for lack of a better system of placing unrealized earnings in either the ERA or principal, and that was based on a determination back in from the Attorney General's office back in 2009 or so, and so it creates a lot of confusion because you would look at this and potentially go, oh, 74.2 billion protected by the Constitution principal, but that's not in fact the case. It's 59.
Last
another
question,
follow-up?
If you
yes.
can.
Okay. Yes. Absolutely. So one of the things that we've heard quite a bit here, especially recently, there's been talks about the ERA and how we manage that and what we can do with it. And you did talk about that just a little bit, but I'm wanting to know what the risks are. Obviously, we've said that there's some previous inflation proofing that hasn't happened, so that money's currently sitting there and available. But what are our risks as we move forward if we overdraw that ERA? Go outside of the principle of 5% POMV, because that is something that can happen, and I just want to know what the risk would be. And if it's not something we can answer simply here, getting that back to the committee with any kind of report or paper on that, that would be very helpful. But just a quick overview would be very helpful. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I mean, we can get you more detail, but generally the balance of the ERA is available for appropriation with majority votes of the two houses of the legislature and concurrence of governor. So to the extent the legislature chose to appropriate more than amounts identified in statute, that would be in their prerogative to do so. Financially or from a fiscal discipline perspective, that would obviously be detrimental to our state's future financial situation. So the concepts behind the permanent fund revolve around an intergenerational equity that we all have a share of this resource when it's our turn, but it's not ours. We don't own the fish in the ocean. We own the right to fish for the fish in the ocean, and we catch what we can and leave enough to provide for the future, and it's the same sort of concept here that it boils down to there is a reliance on each generation of elected official to steward the permanent fund for the benefit of all generations of Alaskans.
We're going to go to Representative Hannon. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. I want to return to a topic in which the legislature and your board have had a disagreement, and it's probably not going to surprise you. The Anchorage office. I'd like an update of how many employees are working there, whether it has been a recruitment tool successfully, which is how your board perceived it, and what our current costs for operating that Anchorage office are.
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, so we have 6 employees currently in the Anchorage office. Next month, we anticipate an additional employee being located there, so 7. We did provide a report to the legislature back in December that quantified the amount of expenditures that had been made on the Anchorage office. both historically as well as on a fiscal year-to-date basis. So last fiscal year was 71.1 thousand, and this fiscal year-to-date, as of October 31st, it was 41.6 thousand. And that's comprised of a variety of smaller expenditures and a lease rate for the facility that they're in of $34,000. As far as the recruitment retention side of the question, it certainly is an option that's perceived as very desirable to the employees that work in the Anchorage office. And so I would suggest that is a recruitment benefit or it's a employee benefit that results in a better ability to retain employees that might otherwise have personal situations or other inputs that they might have medical needs or they might have other situations where they otherwise wouldn't. They would have a difficult time continuing to work for us absent an Anchorage office.
Last follow-up, then we got to move on to the next.
So my follow-up through Chair Josephson is, of those seven employees, how many of them started somewhere else and transferred there versus how many were recruited and their initial employment with us was because they could have Anchorage as a work location?
Director.
Through the Chair, Representative Hannon, two of the employees started working for the fund around the same time the Anchorage office was opened, and they elected to locate in the Anchorage office, and the remainder of the employees worked in Juneau prior to relocating to Anchorage.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to skip slide 22 because we've talked about it.
Okay.
We need to move on to the next part. I want to thank CEO Mitchell and CIO Frampton for their presentation. We're going to take a brief at ease and set up for the department's overview. Thank you, gentlemen.
Yes.
At ease at 2:53. Let's go ahead and continue our work here. We're back on record at 2:55 p.m. We're now going to hear from the Department of Revenue as it presents its FY27 budget overview. With us today from the department is Janelle Earls, Acting Commissioner and Administrative Services Director, and Adam Bryan, Division Operations Manager. Available for questions in the room are CEO Mitchell, who just testified, of course, Pauline Swanson, Communications Director from the APFC, Stacey Barnes, Director of the Governmental Relations and Public Affairs Office for AHFC, the Housing Finance Corporation. Also in line are departmental officers and staff to answer any committee members' questions. And there's a load of them. Many people. Acting Commissioner Earls and Operations Manager Brian, please come forward, put yourselves on the record, and begin your presentation. Oh, I see you here. Do you want, is Mr. Brian with you?
Chair Josephson, he is here, but he doesn't need to unless okay. He wants to.
Okay, okay.
He's got the binder, though.
It's, okay. All right, so here we go. Slide two.
Okay, for the record, Janelle Earls, Acting Commissioner and Administrative Services Director for the Department of Revenue. Slide two is the agenda for today. I'll give a brief overview of the department and move on to the budget components.
Okay. Slide three.
The department's mission is to collect, distribute, and invest funds for public purposes. The department has four core divisions, four corporations and authorities, and also oversees statewide items such as the permanent fund, shared taxes, and debt service.
Okay, questions? Seeing none, we'll go to slide four.
Slide four shows how the department is organized under the commissioner and by division and then by corporation and authorities as they are administratively housed within the Department of Revenue.
Ms. Earls, I don't know the term shared taxes. What is that?
So, thank you, Chair Josephson. There are taxes that come in to the state, but then they are also shared to the municipalities
okay.
in which they come in.
An order of operations kind of thing. Got it. Okay. So there's the org chart. Any questions? I don't see any. So we'll go to slide five.
DOR's operating budget is mainly comprised of other state funds. These funds are typically more restrictive in nature. Examples include retirement system funds and corporate receipts from the Mental Health Trust Authority, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. A summary of major changes will be provided in the slides following.
Okay. Oh, yes. We've been joined by Representative G. Nelson, as we call him. We have many Nelsons. Please continue.
Okay. Thank you. Slide six shows the total costs of across-the-board adjustments for salary, health, and retirement benefits, as well as the IT classification study. I won't go into much detail on these as we go through the slides.
Okay. Quite pro forma, I think. Slide seven.
So all of these components within Department of Revenue's budget do not have any major changes, so I do not have separate slides broken out for them. The only changes they would have are those technical adjustments. But I can answer any questions about any of the components if you have any.
Yes. Representative Ballard.
Thank you. I was looking into doing some bills in reference to child support and father's rights and stuff. So when you have your child support up there and it says collect, distribute child support, does the state get any revenue from that? Or is it a deficit? Do you know?
A cost.
Yes. Is there a cost or
through the chair to Representative Ballard, there is revenue, but it's from the federal government.
Okay.
The Child Support Division is it's under Title 4D program of the Social Security Act.
Okay. Can I just do a quick follow-up?
Yes, follow-up. Representative
Thank
Ballard.
You. Just a little bit for clarification. So say like there's a person who is not paying their child support. and or paying their child support. So we don't charge them for any of that if we have to go after them or
You charge them criminally?
No, I mean, I'm trying to figure out how to say it without it's kind of hard to get my thoughts together. I guess, Chair, if I was delinquent in my child support, which I'm not, I don't have any. Okay, just forget that whole example. If somebody was delinquent in their child support and the state has to intervene saying you have to pay your child support, is there a fee that we charge those persons because we had to have state employees get them to pay their child support before going to jail or whatever? Sorry.
Ms. Earls.
Thank you, Representative Allard. I would defer to Director Tran on the line.
Yes, Director Tran, question about child support and any fees incurred for delinquency.
To the chair, for the record, my name is Boone Tran, and I am the Child Support Division Director. And thank you, Representative Allard, for that question. If public safety is not involved, we do not collect a fee for the client.
I didn't hear that real well. Ms. Earls, do you know?
The way I understood it is there are no fees collected.
Okay.
I'll do another follow-up. Thank you.
All right.
On that same point.
Yes, Rep. Hannon.
I believe the court collects a fee when they have executed child support collections, arrears order, and then directs the division to do it, that the court puts a fee on that civil action?
Don't know.
Chair, that could be.
I spent 9 years of my life working on child support matters, but they were cases where, so not all child support is collected through this agency. It can just be settlements. It can be a court order after very complicated calculations from Rule 90.3 in the civil rules, I think is where it is. Huge amount of case law, dozens and dozens of cases on child support, published cases. So it's a complicated area. Yes, Ms. Earls. Nothing.
I have nothing
okay.
further.
All right. Let's go to slide 8.
So starting our overviews of the components, starting with slide 8, we move into the division summaries. Treasury has a reduction in one long-term vacant position and then just those technical changes due to the salary and benefits adjustments.
Okay. And slide 9.
Alaska Retirement Management Board requires routine legal review as part of due diligence investment requirements. The Department of Law provides all legal services to the ARM Board for all investments, and to better serve the ARM Board in private market investments, the Department of Law has contracted with outside legal counsel, and this cost is passed through from the Department of Law to the ARM Board in the amount of $150,000. There's also a corresponding supplemental related to this item.
Ms. Earls, we have the ARM Board has requested about $34 million more in service fees, essentially the unfunded liability. There's another term for it. Past service liability, I think, is another term for it. Then the governor has requested. Could someone in the room or online describe it? It involves amortization models. That's what's in dispute. Is there some way to edify us on that dispute? Anyone here who can do that?
Director Leary should be on the line.
Okay. Director Leary, are you comfortable describing I wouldn't call it a dispute, but there's a substantial difference in between what the ARM Board, I think, recommends for payment of toward past service liability and what the governor has recommended as an appropriation. Can you tell us what the dispute concerns?
For the record, this is Pam Leary, the Treasury Division Director. The question of comfort is an interesting one. I know that Chair Williams and the ARM Board has provided some information about this through the other body. My understanding is that the ARM Board has approved a certain rate based on a number of different assumptions. And there were a number of different scenarios that were presented. The one that was adopted by the ARM Board, it was partially adopted in the governor's budget, and I believe the difference between those two was about $37 million.
So the target year for a retirement of all of the unfunded liability is 2039. That's a year that is well known and oft repeated. Is this choice impactful in terms of reaching the goal in 2039 of the retirement of the past service liability? In other words, if we go down Trail A instead of Trail B, is it meaningful to get this done by 2039?
Through the chair again, Pam Leary. This is a question really that the actuaries could address. Certainly when you have different assumptions in terms of how you amortize different costs, it will impact, along with many other assumptions, being able to get to fully funding the pension. So it's a bigger question than I think I can respond to right now, but certainly the amortization years is a big contribution to how you get to the end with 100% funding.
Okay, I'll look into this myself. I think the more cautious approach would be to pay fully what the ARM Board wants, so that's where I'm going. I have one of 11 votes on the committee. If the department wants to disabuse me of that position, they're welcome to do that. So let's go to slide 10.
Slide 10 is the ARM Board custody and management fees component. There is a $13.6 million increase for external management profit sharing fees. This additional $13.6 million would indicate outperformance of $54 million. Fees would only be paid to the retirement from the retirement funds if external managers outperformed market benchmarks.
Okay. Slide 11.
For the permanent fund dividend division, there is an increment for $611,600 for cloud server hosting for the new dividend application system. There's also an increase in federal postage rate from July of FY25. We are assuming that there's going to be another increase in July of 2026. We also have an increase in supplemental budget to address this cost for FY26.
All right. Slide 13, or 12, sorry.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority has an increase in $298,500, and this increase is mostly for merit increases, but some increases in contractual services and supplies, not additional, but just the cost of inflation.
Okay. Slide 13.
The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has seen a UGF savings of $685,000 through debt service payments from the AHFC dividend. There were also a reduction in two long-term vacant positions for a savings of $490,000.
Right.
Slide 14.
Yes. Go ahead.
Oh, whoops. Sorry. Slide 13. Oh, no. Sorry. Slide 14. Mm-hmm. I'm still in the subcommittee here. So the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, the biggest thing with them right now is restoring their historical single appropriation structure in the budget. It was broken out last year into multiple appropriations. So that's the biggest part. The increases are mainly to fully fund the incentive compensation program that's currently only funded at about 75%, and then some IT data center equipment and investment subscriptions, smaller costs.
Okay. Slide 15.
Slide 15 is APFC's investment management fees. Again, there's part of the historical budget restructuring, moving $11.9 million back into this component. But then also there was a fairly large reduction in the management fee budget authority of almost $20 million. And that is looking back historically at what they've spent in investment management fees. So it's a net reduction of $8 million, but it really was a good hard look at how do we reduce our costs.
Okay.
In APFC, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation's investment state-owned facilities, there is an increase of, or non-state-owned facilities, an increase of $66,000 and there's $32,000 for increases of the Juno space in the Michael J. Burns building, as well as the $34,000 to fund the lease space in Anchorage.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Ms. Earls, I thought that we, the Permanent Fund Corporation, owned the Michael J. Burns facility, so I guess I'm, why is it considered a non-state facility?
Ms. Searles.
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, I appreciate that question because I've asked it before. The fund owns the building, not the state.
So follow up. So just to make sure I understand it, we're just shuffling money between ourselves, our left hand to our right hand, but it's always, I mean, the building's been owned by the fund for more than a decade, so we must, this must be something that we do every year. Am I correct?
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, it has always been this way, from my understanding. And I'm trying to think of another good way to explain it, because you have to have I believe there is like a manager-type person that manages it, and so we have to pay for that somehow, and you can't pay directly from the fund. So we have to have an appropriation.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Well,
and that is
that was the fastest presentation I've seen.
You're welcome.
So.
Hopefully it's a Friday.
Yeah. I want to thank Acting Commissioner Earls, Operations Manager Brian. That concludes our business for today. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for Monday, February 23rd at 1:30. At that meeting, we will again take up House Bill 280, Apportionment of Taxable Income, Digitized Businesses. Then we will take up House Bill 34, Alaska Innovation Council. Otherwise, we have some other regular legislation hearings next week, so please take a look at that schedule. So with that, I'm going to adjourn today's meeting at 3:14. Thank you, everyone. Have a good weekend. We're adjourned.